Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. As always, we get the most wonderful guests with us. And tonight we have Dr. Molly Ness. Yay, Molly. Hello. And let me introduce Molly for you. Dr. Molly Ness is a former classroom teacher, a reading researcher, and a teacher educator. She spent 16 years as an associate professor of childhood education at Fordham University. Her research focuses on reading comprehension, teachers' instructional decisions, and dyslexia. And if you'd like to find out more about Molly, she has a website, drmollyness.com. And her latest book is Read Alouds for All Learners. And her knowledge will come in handy during this conversation that we are going to have, and it's going to be grounded in an article that recently came out with ILA. It was featured in The Reading Teacher, and it's called New and Not Well-Known Research About Reading Disabilities, Teachers Want to Know. And it came out a few weeks ago. Oh, here it is. Actually, more than a few weeks ago. First published January 23rd. And I'd like to start, Molly, with a quote from the article. And if you could respond, it says here, there are several reasons for reading difficulties, but there are two common sources of reading difficulties in which schools can have a major impact. These two areas are word recognition and language comprehension. These two areas are also associated with two common disabilities that are not well understood by the general public: dyslexia and developmental language disorder, also known as DLD. So let's start there, Molly. Since you do this type of testing and you're very familiar with all the terminology, this article talks about what exactly could be done in school to address these two areas. And the article makes reference in saying that school is really the best place to help children who might struggle in one area or the other. So if you could just comment on that and enlighten our audience.
Sure. Well, let's start with the way that the article categorizes the sort of two buckets of reading challenges. And I want to, even though I'm using the word buckets, I want us to understand that they're not separate silos. Things can overlap. So it's not like you just have struggles with word identification or just have language comprehension issues. They can certainly overlap. But many of us are familiar with the infographic of the Reading Row, Paula Scarborough's 2001 depiction of all the multifaceted strands that go, that weave together to create reading. And we are familiar with those word identification skills as those skills that are sort of finite, meaning they have a clear scope and sequence, a clear sort of end goal. They're the ability of lifting words off the page. And so if we think about dyslexia, really it's those issues that are contributing to a child's skills around word identification. The core of that, of course, which the article does so nicely, is explain the phonological component, that really dyslexia isn't just a struggle of lifting the word off the page, but it's really underneath that, a child's lack of understanding or lack of recognition or lack of fluency or automaticity around the sound structure of our English. So I started down the teacher knowledge of dyslexia in 2010, I believe, where I sort of looked at the population that I was working with at the time, which were teacher candidates, early career teachers, and sort of said, okay, let's take some folks who are literally just about to walk out the door of a several different graduate schools of education, really traditional education preparation programs. I collaborated with a colleague out of state, and we surveyed about 400 teachers. And again, these were people who had done their field placements. They had taken their courses in reading. They had taken their special ed courses. And we asked them really basic questions. What is dyslexia? How do you identify dyslexia? How do you support students with dyslexia? And the thing that blows my mind, and remember, this is 15 years ago, 75% of our population, actually 74, but close enough, 75% of our population identified dyslexia as what we know the misconceptions, seeing words backwards, inverted, reversals, all of those things. And what blows my mind is these were people who were literally just about to receive their degree as a teacher. That research has been replicated and followed up by Wadlington and Aaron Washburn and some other colleagues who have not only replicated that work and extended it, but so there still is a lack or a gap around teacher knowledge about dyslexia. But what I loved so much about this article was the focus on DLD, or developmental language disorder. I am a huge fangirl of Tiffany Hogan, so much to the fact that actually last time I was driving up north, I literally went and parked outside of her lab and said, like, hey, can I come in and like just like because I think you're a genius. It didn't work out at that time. She was sick, but we were going to reschedule. We've got a rain check. But what the article shows and what Tiffany's research is showing is that the same number of kids in a general classroom that have dyslexia, about the same number, same number of kids have developmental language disorder. The challenges are, as we move forward in these conversations around state policies and the science of reading, we're doing a lot of work to identify children's levels around word identification and foundational skills. We are not yet screening them for language disorders. And here's what keeps me up at night. We look at research from organizations like LENA, L-E-N-A, which I can never remember what the acronym stands for. But you can go online and look at lena.org. They are an organization which really looks at language interaction. And they have a really robust set of quantifiable data that shows that our babies, our preschoolers, our toddlers who were home during the pandemic heard less oral language. I get it. I'm a parent during the pandemic. Did I have the patience as I was navigating Zoom meetings and online school and like all, you know, the making 27 meals to do like the language rich scaffolding? No. So what we know is those kids who had less rich language at home, those kids are now our kindergartners, our first graders, our second graders. So when we think about literacy and we think about oral language as the bedrock or the foundation of literacy, we're seeing now this generation of kids that have a shaky foundation in oral language and are going to subsequently have this domino effect or cascade of negative impacts on their literacy. And that's what Tiffany and others in this article show so much about developmental language disorder and how it relates to language comprehension. So I said a lot there because I'm so excited about the focus on DLD most specifically.
Yeah, me too. And that's why you are a perfect guest for today in discussing this article, because certainly that is your passion and you've written about that. So Judy, you know, in the schools, as Molly said, there has been a focus a lot on the foundational skills. And then these programs have been brought in, I think, as a way to address that other part of literacy. But are we really addressing the oral language in K-1 and 2? Or are we just kind of hoping that the program will take care of it? What are your thoughts on that?
So first of all, I want to say thank you to Molly for joining us. Molly, it is such an honor. I've learned so much from you at Professional Development in Person. I've had the pleasure of having Molly write reports for me, for students that I work with privately as well. So you are the perfect person to have here today. And in terms of the schools, so we all know what the schools are going through right now. I've spoken about it many times, growing pains. It's a very pivotal and important time in history, in literacy, right? Schools are shifting towards, you know, a more science and evidence-based approach. A lot of schools have, you know, really prioritized the foundational skills and what that means for students. A lot of schools are now also adopting programs, many of them being knowledge building programs. Some have foundational pieces, some don't. I think right now, to be quite honest, I think there is a hyper focus on quote unquote knowledge building and the foundational skills. And schools are having a hard time, from what I'm seeing, figuring out how to balance that act, especially in the K-2 arena. Because we know it's so important to teach kids how to read. And for many kids, it's not that easy. I mean, I think the statistics in general have been 40% of kids will learn how to read pretty easily and 60% will not. And I think now more than ever, I don't think it's only because of COVID. I think there's many other reasons. Kids are struggling to lift the words off the page, but kids are also struggling in the areas of oral language. And I think that, you know, pacing is very hard. How to, you know, prioritize our minutes. And I feel like a lot of classrooms right now want to get it all in.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're budgeting their times in ways like, okay, we'll do 10 minutes of this and 5 minutes of that.
Yes.
And it's having an impact because teachers right now in the field, from what I'm seeing, not just in my school, just all over and so forth, are so afraid to go over a minute or under a minute because they have to go on to the next thing. And how can you have those rich oral language discussions when you're so worried about just getting through point A to B to C, because this has to be happening, GEOs has to happen, and then Hegarty has to happen, and then foundations has to happen, and then, oh, don't forget knowledge building, that has to happen.
And so, you know what? So you said so much, Judy. Yeah. And all good stuff. But let's bring it back.
But why didn't you give me a cheers button?
I will, sweetie. I will. We just started. I know you want a lot of clapping, but I will.
Why not?
All right. All right. So, Molly, I think Judy said a lot right there, and she's right. As a matter of fact, you and I were just talking about the bloat in a program and then not really knowing how to navigate through the day and what to prioritize. So could you give us a little bit of understanding with how oral language fits in, regardless of whatever program is chosen, if there is even a program? Like, how do we prioritize oral language?
Sure. And I will say that oral language, when you're looking at, if you were to pick up the classic teacher's manual of whatever program, oral language is one of the harder things to provide a script for because it's so highly personal and situated within children's reactions and how the teacher elicits conversations. So to me, it's really a matter of helping teachers understand how to facilitate oral language as opposed to just looking at where to fit oral language in and which program has oral language components in it. I'm a super fan of the new Strive for 5 language comprehension protocol by Sonia Cabell and Tricia Zucker. They're actually former classmates of mine. We went to grad school together at UVA, so wahoo wah. But they have this notion that you take what a student's reaction is, a student's response to whatever teacher question is, and you scaffold up or you scaffold down based on those questions and the answers that were provided. So I really like thinking about that. But in my mind, the number one way to facilitate oral language is through read alouds. And read alouds have been really the focus of my work in the past couple of years, because as we have been so myopically focused on the science of reading and particularly the foundational skills, I want us to understand that read alouds are not a luxury. They're not a waste of instructional time. When we, I get questions like, well, you know, does the science of reading carve space for read alouds? Well, the science of reading, if we look at what the science of reading is, it's a body of knowledge. It is a body of research. And I would argue that there is perhaps more research, more long-standing research on read alouds than many of these other components that we're talking about. And when we look at the body of research around them, we're talking about linguistic benefits, literacy benefits, kids increase their phonological awareness through read alouds, everything to socio-emotional learning, kids' self-identities as readers and writers. So it's not just we are using them for one slice of the literacy diet, but really it's all about that oral discourse, that give and take of language. And so I would caution any schools that are making curricular programmatic decisions, as many schools are, that the read aloud needs to be a cornerstone either of whatever program they're adopting, or it needs to be intentionally brought in if it is not a part of whatever program, because of the richness of the research around it. And I haven't even looked mentioned, you know, the benefits to our kids who have language delays, or kids who have language weaknesses because of, you know, different dialects, or not that dialectical differences are a deficit, but language differences. And so I just think that we really need to carve intentional, mindful space for those read alouds if we are to get to language comprehension, which is all about syntax and semantics and vocabulary and background knowledge and all of those things that happen as we expose kids to intentionally, richly written literature, picture books, middle grade books, all of those things.
Okay. So Judy, you were holding up that cheers button. So come on. Let's do it, because I agree with you. That was big cheers. Yes. So,
Molly, yeah. Get the cheers from a double cheers faster than any of our other guests recently.
I'm not keeping track. I don't know.
He's doing pretty well.
It's funny, whenever I present around read alouds and around the research, teachers and people find it very affirming. Like, I knew I wasn't, you know, quote unquote, wasting time or just doing this for enjoyment. Not that enjoyment's not, you know, a really concrete, important result of read alouds, but people say, like, okay, there's research. Like, can you take this research and show it to my school leader so that they know, there is a need for this.
And if I could just interject, you know, I was a classroom teacher for like a million and one years. And the beauty, you know, I never taught in a school actually that had an actual program. It was modified programs, no programs. But I always had my collection of read alouds, the magic.
I was just going to say the same thing.
Rumpelstiltskin, all those stories, even if some of them were silly, that was like a language experience. And kids started to use their imagination. And you know what I'm seeing with a lot of kids that I work with privately now? They don't even know how to write a fairy tale. They've been doing so much nonfiction.
They haven't even heard fairy tales. Never mind, right? They have
I have
nursery rhymes. They have not heard fairy tales.
So I have parents that come to me. They're like, my kid can write procedural stuff, but they have no idea how to even tell a story. We've lost the art. And I'm scared that, you know, so many people are becoming married to programs right now and afraid to even spend 10 minutes on maybe their favorite read aloud that they want to share with their class. It's just, it's like what Molly said. It shouldn't be that we're squeezing something so important in.
Well, and when we look at, as schools are making these decisions about programs and what's the best use of their resources, one of the things that I often help schools figure out is what are your values around authentic text or sort of contrived text? Meaning a lot of programs don't have a full text there, so they don't see the evolution of a character, or they can't synthesize an idea from start to finish because they're not reading in a text in its entirety. They're reading these little snippets and passages, and snippets and passages are not what make us lifelong readers. So I want to also just know that it's not just the power of storytelling and the language interactions. It's also some of those like discrete comprehension things, skills that we have our kids do, like synthesizing, like mapping out how a character changes, that have to come from these texts that are really meant around to be language facilitating experiences.
So Judy, you and I have had this conversation about different tasks that are asked of very young children in K and one. And we're like, how is that evidence-based? You know, some things that they're given handouts where they have to fill in different things and they're in kindergarten. And it just seems...
Or where kids are being told that they have to find text evidence, but they can't read the words on the page.
It seems inappropriate.
It's kind of rough in the field right now. And I think that, you know, what I'm learning is there is fidelity, right? The F-bomb. But there's also teacher knowledge, and knowing your students still has to matter, right, Molly?
Sure. Absolutely. And I think a lot about how we pigeonhole things, meaning when I think about like a 90-minute ELA block, in my mind, you can take a fabulous picture book, whatever it is, Bad Case of the Stripes, Enemy Pie, whatever. And you can use that picture book for a whole everything. I can do my fluency from it. I can pull word study around it. I can pull, you know, my comprehension and my writing. And so I actually, I don't know, as I've been working recently with schools and choosing programs, I look at these boxes that are 97 workbooks and 38 teacher manuals, and it feels really overwhelming. So I cannot imagine how it feels in a classroom to be navigating those materials that are very sort of, all right, now we're going to focus our 10 minutes on phonics, and next we'll have 25 minutes of X. And then I also think about like how much instructional time we are wasting as we're telling our kids, put that thing away, take this thing out. Like I am much more of the, we can take a rich text and use that as the foundation for so many components. So in many ways, some of these programs like overcomplicate.
That's exactly how I think Judy and I feel. I mean, we've had these conversations before. And I mean, you mentioned A Bad Case of Stripes, and I'm thinking of the word contagious. I've actually used A Bad Case of Stripes to talk about how tier two vocabulary could be pulled out of that and how we could really integrate some of this type of work. So here's my question. Right. After reading this article, it mentions, Molly, two language programs. Let me make sure I have the right names here. Let's Know is a language comprehension program, and Story Champs. What are your thoughts about a language comprehension program?
Sure. So I don't have first experience teaching either of them. So I cannot speak specifically about those. But what intrigues me, and I've used one of the article also references the Cubed, which is an assessment for yes. language comprehension for kids. Because when you read this article, you're like, it sort of smacks you upside the head. Like, wow, we have so many kids in our classrooms that present with DLD, but yet we don't screen them. And we don't talk about this in teacher preparation programs. And I say that I spent nearly 20 years as a professor, as a teacher educator, and I don't think once in my time I talked about DLD. It just wasn't one of the things we talked about. Dyslexia, absolutely. But my point is, like, so we're not screening kids for it. We're not training teachers in it in traditional teacher preparation programs. I hope we are. And I'm sure there are programs that are doing a great job of that. But what excites me is, so you recognize that quandary. You're like, okay, so what do I do? And what I loved about this article is they link you to Cubed, which I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it is a free language comprehension assessment. And I've used it with students that I evaluate, and it's fabulous. The other thing that also excites me about some of those references around language comprehension was that they are open resource. And when I mean open resource, I mean widely available, free. They're not in, you know, glossy, shiny, publisher-created materials. And we're starting to see sort of like an upsurge in some of these open resource materials. The one that's getting a lot of press now because it had a peer-reviewed article behind it was Bookworms, Sharon Walpole's work. Sharon collaborated with my doctoral advisor, Mike McKenna, to create this longstanding program. And it has always been a language comprehension or a background knowledge and language comprehension program, but is really getting, it sort of was overlooked because it was, you know, you could print it for free and it wasn't, you know, like a sales pitch and all the shiny glossy things. And I think when people hear open resource or free, they think bad.
Correct.
So I want us to be really cautious about that. And I also want us to be really cautious. And you've probably talked about this before, that some of these materials didn't receive the green light on Ed reports. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation now about how Ed reports, we can't put all of our eggs in the Ed reports baskets. So for schools who are out there making these decisions, let's be mindful of some of the great free open resource materials.
I'm so glad you said that, Judy. So we had...
why don't you stand up and do a happy dance or something?
I don't have my t-shirt on today, but I'll do this. Okay. But anyhow, I so agree with what Molly...
Of course.
We had on Holly Lane talking about, snake oil and the whole idea that free and low cost doesn't mean that it's any worse than something that costs a lot of money, right? So here we have a lot of, pushing of programs, even though they're saying it's a curriculum, but they're programs. Let's face it. They are programs that people are buying and they're being pushed into buying this. What's your sense, Judy, of as far as how do you think people would be? Would they be receptive to looking at open resources and wanting to be trained to use something that's free and available?
Well, going back to Holly Lane, that episode was incredible. And I remember asking her, so you guys are so good at what you do with the phonics component. Are you guys going to branch out? And she said, no, I'm going to stick in my lane. So
her name, Holly Lane. Stay
right,
in.
Did you have, yeah, exactly. So, but I think it's really, Faith, it's basically... Faith, say the question again.
I want to know how, what you think, if people would be open.
Yeah, I got
something that's free, low cost. Because I think people are sold a story that something costs more involved, it means better. That's my thought.
I think my honest opinion, and this is just an opinion, is... we knew we got something wrong for a very long time, right? Faith, you wrote this book way before Sold a Story. You knew there was a problem. A lot of people knew there was a problem. I knew there was a problem, even though I was in denial. I was going through my own reading recovery journey and then my structured literacy journey, which Molly was a part of when I was on Universal Literacy. That journey was a very special one, moving away from some things that I did in the past. But I think that the initial intention was, we knew we got something very wrong. The data has been stagnant in many places for a very, very long time, way longer than it should have been. And I think people finally accepted that reality. And when you accept that something was so wrong, you want to do something right. And what I think ended up happening is that laws came down, mandates came down, and, you know, people were forced, schools were forced to make very quick decisions. Now, I think the intentions were good. Mm-hmm. And I was the first person that was like, this is the best thing ever. Especially, I was coaching in a school that had no curriculum. I complained about this many years ago, over and over again. It was a do-it-yourself model. And that was very frustrating to me. And I was like, okay, that's finally over. And then we went and you selected three programs. I don't know how much research they had, you know, evidence they had. I know that I did some Googling, you know, I'm not going to name any of them. But I don't think any of them had that strong of an evidence base, but they were adopted and mandated. Now, that program that Molly just mentioned, it wasn't on the list. And maybe it is wonderful. So, Molly, I want to ask your honest opinion. Do you think the adoption process and mandates happened too quickly? And how do you suggest that, you know, schools move forward? Because there's a lot going on and everybody does want to get it right. But how do we do that?
And I see both. This is one of those debates that I love having because I see both sides of it. I love conversations. Right. You're like, you make a good point. You swayed me, but I still feel like this. So on one hand, I applaud the fact, I've been sitting on the advisory council for 2 years. So I've had an inside look at it. And on one hand, I absolutely applaud the sense of urgency to move a system that influences a million kids in a really trying time post-COVID, you know, school attendance, like all of these complications. That is one heck of a pursuit to take on. So I applaud that. And I applaud that, yes, this could have taken 5 years, but that is five more years contributing to children in the system not having fair access to literacy. So on the other hand, yeah, I do think there are some decisions that have been rushed. But again, I get that sense of urgency. And I'm also, you know, I'm doing some of this work on my own now in different schools who are saying, like, help us make a decision about what program we need. And the decision needs to be made tomorrow because we have to get the board approval and we need to put the sales in and we need to, you know, make sure teachers have the materials before they go off in June. And we need to plan for the, you know, professional learning for next year. So I also understand the complications that go into a decision like this and just the nature of school systems. I'm very much looking forward to later this spring when the Reading League releases its resource around curriculum guidance. I had the pleasure of spending some time at Plain Talk with Carrie Curto, and I kept trying to, like, are you sure you can't, like, slip me an advance copy? Like, I'll buy you dinner kind of thing. So I don't have any insider information. And I keep with this district that I'm working with saying, like, something cool is coming out, something cool is coming out. You know, and the challenge, though, is when you look at evidence-based is also a long-haul system. So that article that Sharon Walpole had in, you know, what was it, November or something? She probably started collecting those data 5 years ago, because as somebody who's lived in the process of academic publishing, it's not we have data, let's run it tomorrow and produce the journal. It is, you know, a year of writing it and reviewing and the whole, and then it's, so we have to also keep our eyes on the sense that the notion that this is a longitudinal effort. And I'm so grateful for the conversations when we focus on Mississippi, that they've done this work and are sort of held up as these national leaders. I really, really applaud the leaders who are saying let's not call it the Mississippi Miracle. It was not a miracle. It was a marathon. And we all pulled lots of levers and we did it over 7 or 8 years. And that's what we're starting to see. So what also keeps me up at night, you can tell now I don't sleep very well, is the notion that like, it's going to take some time. And we, as a country, we in our schools,
cheers.
We're not particularly patient. So I fear that we are going to see the next round of NAEP or the next round of whatever assessment we're using. And we're not going to see bumps, because we're doubling down on foundational skills, not, you know, really, really considering language comprehension. The tests are language comprehension tests. And then we're going to sort of like throw our hands up and say like, oh, we tried that science of reading thing. It didn't work.
I've said this many times, Molly, that that's exactly the direction. When I see how people are pushing certain programs and they're doing this quickly, and I've said, I could see this all falling apart and then the naysayers coming back in a couple of years saying, see, they didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah,
and you see, it's a bunch of BS.
Yep. I see signs of it on social media. People are like, oh, kids don't enjoy reading anymore. They enjoyed reading more during the balanced literacy days and so forth. And part of me is there was a little bit more joy. And I think, was it the best? Probably not, but kids were holding books more. They were doing more read alouds before. I think the thing is, with all these programs coming out, people are looking to them like they're the Bible and forgetting that they're just a guideline. There still has to be a careful eye looking at, okay, this is what's working for my kids. This is what's not. And I think it's also like, I see a lot of these programs cover a lot of standards. Today you're doing this standard. Tomorrow you're doing that standard. Tomorrow, we have to look at, like,
you a second.
Yeah. I'm getting, but you know what? It's funny because when Molly was speaking, I literally wanted to have tears in my eyes because there is an urgency, right? I work in some of the poorer school districts and, you know, there's so many people that are ready to give up on these kids. They'll be like, oh, the parents don't do this, or and I think the article mentioned the parent component, but it's kind of frustrating because, like, we have these kids under our care, and this is something I did learn from my reading recovery days. It was to self-reflect about what we can do differently within a certain amount of time. So we're with those kids for 7 hours a day, and it's very easy to say, oh, the parents don't do enough, so I'm giving up on them. And I look at those kids every day, Faith, and I think, you know what? The whole system is ready to give up on these kids. We cannot.
All right, so Molly, Judy mentioned the F-bomb, and we make a joke about that, you know, the fidelity piece. What are your thoughts about fidelity when teachers are given a program and they're being told they have to use the program with fidelity, and yet we know that there are either components that are missing or they're overloaded with tasks that are not necessarily appropriate? What do you about fidelity?
Or a standard a day that keeps the doctor away? No, it doesn't.
Yeah. So I will comment briefly about fidelity and then I'll introduce another F word that I've been thinking about. So in terms of fidelity, I think fidelity and social science or and education in particular, like it's nearly impossible to have. I think when I think of fidelity, I think much more of like the medical practices and such. You can't have classroom A does not look like classroom B. And there are so many factors and contexts specific to each classroom that I think fidelity is really challenging and therefore negates a teacher's ability to provide responsive instruction. So the fidelity thing, I think, is tricky. And I don't want us to get lost in the weeds of you spent 4 minutes on an activity that the teacher's manual slotted for 2 minutes. that certainly is worrisome. The other F-bomb that I will introduce is feasibility. And I am, this is not me. This is, I'm borrowing from the brilliance of Kareem Weaver, who talks about feasibility. And by that he means, and as a former classroom teacher, I will never forget, the best advice I got as a first year teacher was from the veteran teacher down the hall, who said that teaching is about begging, borrowing, and stealing. So I am borrowing from Kareem Weaver and using feasibility. And feasibility is, okay, what is it actually like to go into a classroom and try this out? How do I navigate the 18 different workbooks and the, you know, all of those little things? Because when you look at some of these programs and try to wrap your head around what it actually means in a classroom context, we have some real challenges with feasibility. And my hunch is that what we've done is we've taken programs and we've layered upon layer upon layer so that the program meets whatever state mandated list or state approved list, rather than really, and then we're putting it on the teacher or the school systems to figure out what's essential, what's, you know, would be nice if we had extra time. And so I always like to think that more isn't always better. More is just more when we look at some of these. And the feasibility thing is has to be considered. So I think what schools need to be doing as they're choosing programs is do some feasibility outreach. So I'm working with the district now that as they're trying to think through, you know, they brought in the salespeople, they've gotten the materials, they're looking at the research, they're using the guidelines from Reading League and Knowledge Matters and all these other things. They're looking what's on each different state lists, but they're also networking with schools in districts that have used Program X. And they're saying to them, what was great? What wasn't so great? What were some of the bumpy parts? What did you do to, so they're doing that feasibility work. Tell us what it's like to take this program and implement it in a fourth grade classroom or second grade classroom, because that feasibility is really a significant challenge.
But don't you have to already have some level of understanding of what a really solid curriculum looks like? We're not talking about program, talking about curriculum, which goes back to being well-trained, well, you know, informed correctly about what goes into this in order to make those careful decisions.
Absolutely. And so I think the districts that I enjoy working with are ones that start the process before there's any mention of programs or curriculum. All they do is they spend a year. What is the science of reading? How do kids develop to become readers? What is the gist? They're not talking about, you know, wonders or, you know, whatever. They're literally just talking about the process of reading. And then when everybody has that foundation, then they can start their resources and say, we've got a gap here. This is working. Let's keep this in place so that you're not making decisions that are without a context, without buy-in, and without a real understanding of why these changes in this direction now.
Okay, that's another cheers. And I want to talk about that too. But Judy, would you?
I could read the ideas in your head, Faith. You're talking to me telepathically right now. I know exactly what you're thinking.
Yes, you know exactly what I'm thinking. That's not what we're hearing.
Yeah.
Social media. At all, at all. As a matter of fact, when I bring these things up, I'm being told I'm anti-curriculum, which I don't even think the people who say it know what that even means. I'm anti-curriculum. I am not anti-curriculum. I'm not anti-program. I'm pro making good decisions the way you just said to make decisions, Molly. Yeah. So, Judy. I'm looking at you. So one of the things in this article, they mentioned story retell, and I know you're big on assessments. Is the retell portion being used?
Yes.
And how is it being used? Do people understand how important story retell is for assessment purposes?
Yeah, so comprehension, first of all, I think is one of the biggest challenges to unravel how you assess for comprehension. I don't think the field has settled particularly well. And so when we think about retellings, really what we're talking about in research lingo is a verbal protocol. It is your ability to do with things in a linear fashion, to differentiate essential from non-essential. So, you know, you're not going into a whole tangent about what the character ate for dinner, but you're identifying who the character is. So all of those things go into retell. And I think there is a lot of strength in it. When I was a doctoral student at the University of Virginia, we had a reading clinic. And one of the first things that we would do, young children, many of them, in fact, were pre-readers, was a protocol by a researcher from Harvard named Alyssa McCabe. I don't know if she's still around, but she had this notion of give a story to get a story. So I, as the clinician, would tell a story. And usually what we did, we would tell stories. We would often go in with a Band-Aid that was like really visible. You know, like 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds always see that. And they're like, what happened? And so you, as a clinician, make it up this whole intricate story of, oh, well, let me tell you what happened first. I felt, you know, and the whole, I got stitches and the ambulance came, this whole thing. Did anything like that happen to you? And so basically what you're doing is you're modeling how to tell a good story in sequential order, with details, with, you know, conflict or resolution, with sophisticated vocabulary. So you're modeling and then you're asking the child to do it themselves. And you tell them to, there's some prompts that work really well. An injury works really well, a bee sting. Some of these you have to like make up in the moment, but it doesn't work so well to ask a kid, you know, tell me a story about your birthday party, because what we know is that kids can't always like differentiate. Oh, that was my, they'll tell the stories of like their friend's birthday party and not just their birthday. And it just becomes this like whole convoluted mess. But the idea here is that what you're getting at just by doing that give a story to get a story from Alyssa McCabe is that you're getting children's measures of language comprehension, how much language they're exposed to, that they know the structure of a story, that they can listen to a model and then take that and use it to springboard into their model. And it's one of my favorite things to do. I should look back at that research from Alyssa McCabe about that, because it really is getting into the foundations of developmental language disorder, and those sorts of tasks would be difficult for children who present with DLD.
Judy, could you jump on that, please?
All right. So to be quite honest, you know, schools were doing running records for a very long time. They took a lot of time. And there were a lot of comprehension questions on those assessments. Now, we know that we didn't do the best job as educators, probably teaching a lot of that, right? We were just asking questions and questions and questions without, you know, going deep into the metacognition and teaching the strategies that go along with those things. Now, running records are pretty much, I think, history for most people, although, you know, I still collect notes when kids read with me informally and so forth. So from what I'm seeing now in a lot of K-2 classrooms, screeners have become a big priority, which test a lot of the foundational skills. Then there's also the oral reading fluency, better known as the ORF. And students have to read a passage on their own, and then they are expected to retell. Now, the problem with that, A, I think a lot of the stories are outdated and should be updated personally, but that's my opinion. That's not based on any evidence or research. The problem is a lot of kids can't get through the passages. There's a lot of lines of text going on. A lot of the kids haven't broken the code. I think that for a lot of kids, they're reading and they don't realize that they have to now retell something that they read only one time. You know, for some kids, that task is easier than others. But I think that besides the oral reading fluency. Schools are now depending on assessments that a lot of programs have. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see. So, you know, I see some assessments are long passages. Now the kids can't read the passage. So now instead of becoming a reading comprehension task, it's becoming an auditory task where the kids are listening to the passage. Some people are probably reading the passage to the kids twice. Some are not reading it at all. So there's not a lot of norming. And that's a very different skill to listen to something and be able to answer orally versus being able to read it on your own orally. To be quite honest, I don't think we're focusing enough on the comprehension pillar because so many people right now in the field, especially in the younger years, are so focused on having kids lift those words off the page. And then I don't think the pillar of comprehension in conjunction with writing is getting enough attention. I'm also seeing a lot of kids that can read, but then they can't show that they comprehended what they read in a written format. So there's, I think it's a little messy right now in my perspective.
So Molly, last thoughts with this article in terms of if you want to leave our audience with whether it's tips or any last thoughts about this article or a message that you'd like to leave as we wrap up.
Yeah, practicality is key.
So I've always been interested in teacher knowledge and teachers' instructional decisions. So I will relate it back to that. To me, the big takeaway is we have to understand the role of language comprehension in reading and what happens when language comprehension is a source of struggle for students. We have to better train our pre-service teachers as well as support our people who have been in the field for a while who are not familiar with, by no fault of their own, developmental language disorder. We have to keep the notion that oral language is the foundation of literacy, that all of our pillars of literacy rest on that bedrock, and that when we are aware of not only how to assess kids' oral language, but most importantly, how to facilitate it and build it, that is just as essential as those foundational skills.
Perfect. Molly, thank you so much for joining us. As I said earlier, we will put all your information in the show notes. Judy, could you please wrap up for us?
Thanks a lot, Molly, for being with us. Follow us on our newly designed website, theliteracyview.com, where you can find all our social media platforms. And that's it. Join us on our Facebook group, Real Teachers Letting Loose, The Literacy View, Instagram, all those good places. Share our work, share it with your friends, spread the word, and write us some good reviews. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks
so much.